Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope, and I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm absolutely delighted today to be joined by Dr. Claire Kelly, who's an associate professor in the School of Psychology in Trinity College Dublin, and also a member of the Independent Scientific Advocacy Group. Claire, thanks so much for joining us today on Reboot Republic.
Thanks for having me, Rory. I'm delighted to be here.
Great. And just a reminder to our listeners, we really appreciate those who are patrons, who are supporting us. And if you're not a patron, please consider supporting Reboot Republic. And you can sign up each month for whatever you can. You can pay a fiver, 10 or 20 euro, and you will get access to all the shows first across the platform and also support what we're doing. We really appreciate it. Thank you. Claire, we've had a major announcement yesterday from government in relation to the opening up and various dates set out around the plan to open up. What is your sense? We've saw also, of course, the World Health Organization this week warning European governments around the pace of opening up, particularly with new variants and just the danger again of more waves of COVID. And what is your sense and how do you what's your kind of response to the government's plan as it set out yesterday?
Yeah, I think like everybody, I was taken by surprise at the extent of the reopening plans, and like many others, see it as a really significant gamble that the government are taking on, you know, what's going to happen over the next couple of months. Now, I've been wondering what has driven this, you know, the extent of this reopening, and it seems in some ways that the government have been. I think they're reflecting, you know, they're being driven by pragmatism a little bit. They get a sense that people are really sick and tired of this very prolonged and what's really been quite an ineffective lockdown that, you know, lacked any kind of clear objective or goal other than that we should just hold firm. You know, the government back in February, you know, made quite a big deal about focusing on data rather than dates. But in this current plan, they seem to have let go of that ideal completely. And now we're back entirely to focusing on dates rather than data. Now they have, you know, I know Micheál Martin has said that they will pay attention to metrics like cases, but also things like hospitalizations and ICUs, ICU admissions. But, you know, they haven't given any specifics on that at all. And so it's quite concerning that where we are now, which is, you know, case numbers of about 400 to 500 a day, cases increasing in the past week or so, that we're actually, you know, in terms of case numbers, we're in a worse situation than we were when we relaxed all the restrictions at the beginning or the end of November, beginning of December. And we all know where that ended up. Now, we do have, of course, the you know, the fact that we have vaccinations in the mix and you know, a very substantial number of our most vulnerable, the most elderly, those with significant underlying conditions have been vaccinated. But, you know, in terms of our overall population, only about 20% of people, you know, that includes children. So 30% of those over 16, 20% of the full population have been vaccinated. And we know from other countries that vaccination alone doesn't bring down the case numbers. So we've seen in other places in the world, including places like Israel, which had a hugely effective and very rapid vaccine rollout. Despite that vaccine rollout, they had an enormous surge in case numbers. Places like Chile, which have had a disastrous a wave of infection. Hungary, which was, again, having a very successful rollout, but also experienced a huge surge in cases. So you know, with cases the way they are here on this knife edge, and even increasing in recent days or in the recent week, I'm very worried about what will happen as a result of the relaxation of restrictions.
And I think that, you know, it seems to be a little bit like, you know, we're all, you know, in many ways, you know, so confined in so many ways. And, you know, people want to see families and, you know, people are in such difficult situations, been out of work. And you can feel that, you know, pressure from society. But on the other hand, we also know people have gone along with this because they realize that if we do open up, what will happen? Because we have lived through these waves already. We saw what mm-hmm. happened. And of course, we have the new variant, you know, being the dominant one now, B117, and the impact of that. And, you know, we're seeing it in schools and places like that. What is your sense, or do you have a view on the fact that it appears that, you know, NPHET advised or gave, you know, advice to government, or it's definitely been framed in that way that, you know, this increased opening has been essentially given the backing by NPHET and their estimations? Do you have a response to that?
Yeah, I noticed that a lot in the politicians' framing of why they are opening up. They were essentially saying, "Well, NPHET has said it's okay, you know, or NPHET are telling us to do this, so we're going to open up." Mm. Which is interesting that you know they will listen to NPHET when it suits and not when it doesn't.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen the NPHET letter, actually. I was looking for it. I don't believe it's publicly available yet. It doesn't seem to be on the website. So I don't know the details. I don't know, you know, the models and the risk assessments on which NPHET are making or have made their recommendations. And, you know, like, it's completely understandable that at this point people are really eager to open up. I mean, I am certainly very eager to open up. I haven't, my family are scattered all over the country. I'm based in Dublin, but everybody's, you know, been beyond the travel restrictions.
Yeah.
And I'm desperately looking forward to, you know, getting to see the sea again of Donegal, which is where I'm from. And, you know, people have really put up with a very, very long lockdown, and it's just unfortunate that lockdown was not as effective as it should have been, given, you know, given how long it was and given the restrictions we were under. And I think that's the most troubling aspect of, I suppose, this kind of move to a really comprehensive reopening, is that, you know, did the government really use this lockdown in the way that it should have been used? So did they, you know, build up our public health resourcing in a way that could cope with an increase in cases in the coming weeks as we open up? You know, is retrospective contact tracing now fully resourced so that we can truly track down and break the chains of transmission? My understanding is that that's not the case. You know, we haven't really enabled public health in the way that it should be, in the way that would enable it to fully respond to an increase in cases. Similarly, you know, we haven't enabled people to isolate where they have difficulty isolating. So we have lots of people who are living in cramped conditions, living with many other people, and if they get come down with COVID, then they're very likely to infect everybody else in that house or household, because they can't isolate, because the newer variants that we have, or, you know, the B117, which is the dominant variant now, is so much more transmissible. And the government haven't really provided anything additional to enable people in those conditions to self-isolate. There's been so much that could have been done. Of course, you know, we could have been at zero. And then that's what, you know, ISAG's position is, that if this lockdown had been used in the way that it could have been, if it had been as effective as, you know, as we recommended it should be, then we would be at zero now, and we would be enjoying enjoying all this reopening in a safe way, instead of in this very risky, in this gamble that's been taken at the moment.
Just on that, I think that is interesting, that, again, the way I was kind of, you know, listening to Micheál Martin yesterday, it's almost like, yeah, we're moving to this place now where we won't have to worry about COVID to the same extent.
Yeah.
And to me, that seems a complete wrong, a misrepresentation of where we're at in terms of this virus. What would your sense of that be?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think what was most troubling to many of us listening to, I suppose, the radio and watching the news yesterday, was that people were essentially taking these announcements of the relaxation of restrictions as almost as an announcement that the virus is gone and we don't need to worry about this anymore, which is really surprising given, you know, what we've been through. But, you know, it's also understandable, like I said, given the restrictions everybody's been living under and their real desperation to begin living again. And it's just really troubling that we are going to have this very large reopening. We know that what happens is that people, I mean, you know, humans in general are generally quite poor at understanding risk. And when we're told, you know, when we receive information from the government that, you know, particular behaviors are permitted. So, you know, if we think back to December when the indoor dining is permitted, we often take that as an indication that those behaviors are safe. And some of that, you know, confusion could be blamed on the government, for example, who've said repeatedly that schools are safe. They're clearly not safe, but we are prepared to take the risk involved because of the value of schools and education to society. And that should have been how it was stated rather than, you know, this mantra that schools are safe. Similarly, we know that, you know, indoor dining carries a really significant risk. We know that, you know, we know now more than ever, even though it's never, I don't know if it's ever really been very clearly stated either by our government or HICWA, that this virus is airborne and that indoor spaces constitute the greatest risk for transmission of the virus, particularly crowded indoor spaces and spaces where people are talking or singing or shouting, you know, the indoor spaces associated with socializing. And those pose really significant risks.
How would you have framed it then if you were presenting that yesterday?
Yeah,
not to put on the spot or anything.
Perhaps a little bit. I mean, I suppose that, yeah, that's part of the framing has to be that this virus is not gone away. That yes, we have, you know, the incredible contribution now of vaccines, whereby many of our most vulnerable are protected. But that doesn't give us a carte blanche. That doesn't, you know, take away all the risks of the virus. We still have to be as mindful as we have been. And, you know, I think part of the problem is that in general, there's a focus, a very strong focus on hospitalizations and deaths as the only negative outcomes of SARS-CoV-2 infection and COVID-19 illness. You know, we know there's a growing evidence and very strong evidence about this syndrome called long COVID, these long-lasting, you know, disabilities essentially associated with the virus. And unfortunately, that syndrome, that condition doesn't discriminate in terms of age. So it occurs in children as well as adults. It occurs across the whole span of people who have been infected with COVID-19. And it even happens in those who've been asymptomatically infected, it seems. And, you know, we don't fully understand that syndrome. We don't fully understand how long it lasts. But, you know, there's very troubling evidence, for example, to show that people, you know, experience long term, so several months after their infection, They show long-term, you know, respiratory difficulties, fatigue, but most troublingly, they show long-term cognitive and, you know, mental health symptoms. So they these things known as like brain fog and you know, difficulty thinking properly, you know, people and people that's can be associated with their fatigue, but also a direct reflection of the impact of the virus on the brain. So again, this is all emerging evidence, and we don't fully understand what happens with the virus and the brain, but we know the virus can directly infect the brain, but it also causes inflammation that damages the brain. And, you know, Gabriel Scali, for example, has been, you know, calling people's attention to the fact that the Spanish flu, so that, you know, pandemic that happened 100 years ago, people who were born during that pandemic were much more and had been infected with the virus were much more 2 to 3 times more likely to develop a Parkinson's-like illness later in life. And the suggestion is that the virus infiltrated the brain and it kind of hid out there and had very, very negative long-term effects many, many years after the original infection. And there are some people who think that infection with SARS-CoV-2 could have similar effects, but of course, we don't know yet. And in the absence of that knowledge, shouldn't we, you know, be as cautious as possible and protect as many people as possible from infection with this virus? And what worries me about this opening up plan is that there, you know, it comes with an acceptance of a certain number of cases. Those cases will happen in younger people who, yes, we know don't get as sick, are less likely to end up hospitalized or less likely to die. Not completely unlikely. We're still going to see some deaths and some hospitalizations as a result of increasing cases amongst younger people. The bodies may not pile in their thousands, you know, as Boris said, but there still will be deaths as a result of this. But there may be, you know, many thousands of people who will experience this long COVID. So the estimates coming from the UK at the moment are about 1 in 7 of those who were diagnosed with COVID-19 suffer from long COVID. And, you know, my perspective on that is that we should do everything that we can to prevent that and to reduce the number of infections.
I think that, you know, what you've set out there is, you know, was absolutely missing, was absent yesterday in terms of that discussion, that impact of long COVID and even the deaths. And we've seen that, you know, it's been explicitly, well, not so much explicitly, but said that, you know, this idea of acceptable deaths. And I think you're right that it shouldn't just be acceptable deaths put in there. It should also be included that the long COVID, how many people are we accepting that will suffer from this, that, as you say, we don't fully know the implications. Well, we do know in terms of, you know, within months afterwards, but we don't know, as you say, these longer term implications. And what would indicate from a, you know, because obviously there's potential of anything, of lots of things to happen, you know, from lots of diseases, but why specifically the neurological concern around COVID, or is there specific around neurological potential longer term impacts?
Yeah, it seems to have an increased incidence of these neurological, neuropsychiatric symptoms. So there was a paper about a month ago published in, I believe it's in one of the biggest medical journals, demonstrating that 30% of those who had a COVID-19 diagnosis experienced these neurological and psychiatric symptoms. So many of them were related to increased anxiety and depression, but there were also things like encephalitis, so very worrying neurological syndromes, and that these were seen at a greater rate with COVID-19 than other infections. So it does seem to have an increased risk of these kind of infections, and that may be to do with it's the inflammatory effects of the virus that we don't fully understand, but we know can very negatively impact the brain and in a long-term way.
And obviously that's, as you say, very significant in terms of if we're looking at cases, you know, potentially well, there will be tens of thousands of cases, you know, in the coming weeks and months and as we open. What things are there things that you would do differently from the plan as set out?
Well, it's what I would have done differently was several months ago.
Well, yeah, I understand that. But from where we are now,
where we are now, yeah. I mean, I think that one of the most important things is that we really have to break those chains of transmission. So, you know, fully fund our public health system to do its job, which, you know, is quite unbelievable to me that a year and a bit into this pandemic, you know, our public health doctors are still crying out for resources. And like we've called for all along is support people to isolate so that, you know, there isn't transmission. It's really tough. I really dislike the fact that the ISAG are seen as the party poopers and the eternal lockdown group, which we, you know, emphatically
are just
a
bunch of miserable cranks.
We just want to make everybody sad. And so I'm absolutely,
you're the Christmas Scrooge, isn't that it?
That's it. I mean, but you know, if
which is such a ridiculous, no, but that is the portrayal.
Listened,
it's like,
would have been saved, you know, how many lives would have been saved in January?
I'd put it better as you're the adults in the country.
I think that's it's a nice idea. I mean, you know, it's funny because we're the ones listening to the science, you know, but part of the problem, and I think this has been a huge problem throughout this pandemic, is that I think people have become a little bit disillusioned with science because, unfortunately, people have a perception that science is about black and white and about, you know, being able to look at the data and give a definitive answer. And of course, it's not, right? Like, science is all about different levels of uncertainty. And the thing about this pandemic is it's a completely new virus. And so what we've known and understood about it has changed dramatically over the course of a year. And I've been really struck by the fact that it seems that Ireland in particular has always been a little bit behind on the science, right? Like we were slow to take up masks, for example. We've been slow to, you know, fully recognize and endorse the fact that this is an airborne illness and that, you know, transmission happens, through aerosols rather than surfaces and fomites, you know, so things that necessitate the constant cleaning of hands and surfaces. The air is much more relevant in the context of this. So a little bit more, I think that attention to that fact will be really important for this reopening, especially once they start about talk and once they look at reopening indoor and dining, but even the outdoor dining, you know, people still have to go in and out to use the bathroom. You know, of course, we're going to be bringing back many people into the workplace. They're all interacting indoors, you know, people working in cafes and restaurants and hotels, they're working in fairly small spaces that may not be very well ventilated. And you know, Orla Hegarty from UCD has been really trying to draw attention to the importance of ventilation and the simplicity of it, you know, that it requires simple CO2 monitors to measure the necessity of ventilation and how well the ventilation is working, and which, you know, can then be rectified. But I you know, we really need to look to the science on some of these things to make sure that this reopening happens safely. And the same thing was the case with schools. You know, we tried to really appeal when we were looking at reopening schools after that 6-week closure at the beginning of the year. You know, we can look all around the world to things that have worked elsewhere to keep schools safe and to reduce the transmission of the virus that happens in schools, that we know happens in schools, which again, we've been quite slow in Ireland to recognize. But elsewhere around the world, they, you know, used hybrid learning approaches where kids were in school some days and at home others. So it reduced class sizes, it reduced the number of people interacting at schools. We have masking, children in primary schools wearing masks, which is very effective. Again, the importance of ventilation, the CO2 monitors and making sure that there's enough air changes in the classroom, which is an enclosed space with lots of people in it, all talking and especially at the younger ages, shouting and potentially moving around. And, you know, we made a really strong appeal for some of those mitigations to be implemented here to improve the safety of schools. And really nothing was done. And now we can see that there are many outbreaks in the schools, and the schools are contributing to community spread.
Yeah, it seems to strike me that figure, and I think it was Tomás Ryan yesterday corrected Cormac on Drive Time when he said that, and you put it again, we're saying 20% of the population were vaccinated, and he said, well, no, actually children aren't, and that you know, and you said it earlier, that how important again is that framing that, you know, children are also, you know, vulnerable to this disease, can get it, can spread it, and you know, do you think we're talking enough about that? Or
no, we're not. And I think particularly in the context of long COVID and these potential neurological effects, it's really troubling that we're happy to seemingly happy to allow children to become infected, you know, on the basis that they don't suffer very significant symptoms now, even though we know, you know, there are some kids who get very, very sick. And there's this, post-viral inflammatory syndrome that's seen that's quite specific to COVID-19. That's very troubling. You know, but again, these are viewed as acceptable, acceptable amounts of illness and acceptable amounts of potentially serious illness, so that we can reopen the economy and society.
I want to come back to you on that, because it's something that you had mentioned that you'd like to talk about, which is that whole psychology and of behavior and decision making. But just before I go on to that, I do want to talk about briefly the mandatory hotel quarantine, because that seems to me still a gaping hole. Like, we've implemented it somewhat, but not all. What's your analysis of that? Is it an effective and what could it be?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's great that they have brought it in. It's unfortunate that it is not comprehensive to be fully effective at keeping the variants out, which is the main goal of the mandatory hotel quarantine. You know, we have to have it apply to everybody. And, you know, we have this, I know we have this challenging situation of the land border and our common travel area with the UK. But, you know, the fact that we cannot impose mandatory hotel quarantine on people traveling from the UK means that we're exposed to everything that they are exposed to. And we know they've had increasing numbers, for example, of the very troubling Indian variant in recent times. Now, they have now taken action on travel from India, and I believe we're adding India to our mandatory hotel quarantine list. But in some ways, those actions can be taken too late, and you think about, you know, what was shown. I know people have spoken about this a bit, but it was something that we discussed in one of the ISAG webinars, the data from Paddy Mallon's group in UCD that showed that, you know, last summer, our first lockdown in Ireland was so effective that we effectively did eliminate the virus from Ireland. And what happened over the course of the summer is that an entirely new variant of the virus was seeded. And that's what led to our second wave.
Seems that the government are about to repeat that experiment again by removing mandatory hotel quarantine and opening up in July.
And travel to open back up. I mean, it's quite amazing to me that that's the conversation that's now happening. Is that it's this mentality that, oh, you know, the virus is gone, and I'm not sure, you know, is it just a complete faith in the vaccines that's driving that mentality, and if so, then that's a really risky perception. And like I said, evidence from all around the world, from various countries, from including Israel, but also Chile, Hungary, where they had effective vaccine rollouts and yet enormous surges in infections. If we let a variant get in, particularly a variant that has, immune breakthrough, that breaks through the vaccines, like the South African variant does, then, you know, we're putting ourselves back to square one. And that's the really big worry here.
That in terms of the variant coming in, but isn't it said that most of the vaccines that we would be administering are, again, the phrase used, you know, quite effective or relatively effective or efficacious against the variants?
Most of them are, but I think what's known as the South African variant, and they are less effective against that. Now, AstraZeneca had the lowest efficacy against it. I don't know the specific numbers for, say, Pfizer or Moderna. But there was, as far as I know, there was some evidence that they had reduced efficacy against it. And also P1 doesn't have as much breakthrough as the South African variant, but the South African variant seems to be quite troubling in this regard. And I think it's probably not known yet about the Indian variant. But the trouble is, these variants, clearly are emerging. You know, we give them these names that are associated with a particular place, but, you know, that's not where they stay. They travel all over the world. And they're being given space to evolve. And what's most worrying is if they are given space to evolve in the context where some of the population are vaccinated. So they're given a perfect learning ground in which to figure out how to break through that protection offered by the vaccines. And that could be really, really troubling and could literally set us back to square one. And you know, have lost all the efforts of the last year.
And of course, none of that potential scenario discussed yesterday.
No, so that probably leads me on a little bit to those frailties of human cognition. They're maybe playing a role here, and I suppose one of the biggest ones that is really important for human resilience, but could also it also acts to our detriment, is optimism bias. Just the idea that, you know, when it applies to a specific person, it's, you know, that I'm less likely to experience negative effects or negative events than other people. But you know, on a more national scale, maybe that the country is less likely to experience the negative events, the waves, the third and fourth waves that we see elsewhere. And there's a related belief of, you know, lightning never strikes twice, right? So what happened in December won't happen again. Part of that thinking reflects the fact that humans are just pretty bad. We're not good actuaries. We're not intuitive actuaries. So thinking about probabilities and risk is just not something that we do very well. And that's made even more difficult where those probabilities and risks are quite unclear, right? They're affected by very significant factors like age. So we know, you know, the risk of, say, serious illness differs according to age when it comes to COVID. So, you know, it's understandable that we struggle to think through some of these things. But I think that this, you know, generally a very optimistic outlook, while really important for resilience and being positive, could be to our detriment. I mean, it's certainly to our detriment with respect to, you know, the climate crisis. And, you know, I think a year ago I was drawing contrasts between our response to COVID and our response to climate, or our inaction to the climate crisis. And, many people were drawing this contrast and saying, wow, like, you know, people who are trying to motivate action on climate can really draw on the experience of COVID and say, look, you know, this spurred, you know, really immediate and global action, collaboration and sense of community. And now a year in, unfortunately, there are now more similarities between lack of action on COVID and lack of action on climate. I think one of the things that we talk about in the context of the climate crisis is this problem of the effects being felt very far away. We know that there are many parts of the world, and particularly developing countries, where the effects of climate will be much more harshly felt than they will be felt in Ireland, for example. So, flooding and climate-related migration, famine, and food shortages that we won't feel here. But a similar thing seems to be happening now with, the enormous surges of the virus and the terrible consequences and infections and deaths happening in places like India and Brazil. And we seem to be just turning away from that. And again, the optimistic interpretation is that that won't happen here.
It's very, very interesting. I think you were referring to, and maybe the last one, was that the temporal discounting that you referred to?
Yeah, so the temporal discounting is another really interesting bias where we tend to prefer kind of an immediate hit over long-term benefit. So we value something that we can get more, that we can get now, over something that comes in the future. And I think that's probably certainly playing a role in everybody's appetite for the reopening, right? Like we really just want some reward now. We want a reward for our, the penance of the last, whatever it is, 3-4 months. Everybody wants to get their hair cut. Everybody wants to get out and socialize again. So we really want these rewards now, and we're kind of, I suppose, forgetting about what the long-term benefits would be of really getting the case numbers down to where we effectively eliminate this virus, and what the rewards that we would reap then would be. But that kind of temporal discounting, that tendency to prefer the immediate over the long term, it is affected by many factors like uncertainty. So the more uncertain that future payoff is, the more likely we are to prefer the one that we can get now. And it's also known to increase when under conditions of scarcity. So, for example, and people who've been exposed to poverty tend to prefer the immediate over the long term. And, it's not that we've all been exposed to poverty, but we have been restricted in terms of what we've been able to do. So our access to resources and rewards has been restricted, and now they're going to be released. So it's possible that we will have a strong preference for immediate rewards over those long-term benefits because of that prolonged lockdown.
It reminds me a lot of how watching my kids interact and trying to convince them that, wait a while and are for some, delayed gratification ideas but the government aren't kids, and the government understand this surely. And would you not think that they would be operating out of, I assume, in terms of what you're setting out there, is these are, psychological approaches or, behavior that we learn to modify, adapt within a society and try and bring in other influences on us to influence our decisions.
Yeah, I mean, I can't pretend to have a good understanding of all the different factors that the government has to take into account. And of course, the economy is a huge one. And I don't want to downplay, the enormous suffering of particularly small businesses, over the course of the last year. And, there's a understandable appetite to get many of those small businesses reopened again. I think it's just a shame that we didn't, that this wasn't done in the way that it should have been done. That would have enabled, a massive reopening of our domestic economy over the course of the summer through an effective lockdown in the earlier part of this year. And so now what I'm really worried is that we will get this, immediate hit. We'll get that immediate reward of people getting to reopen again. There'll probably be, there is an expectation that there will be kind of really significant spending. A lot of people, lucky people, of course, who've been able to save money over the past year are itching to spend that money. So there will be a short term boost to the economy. But, if this reopening doesn't go well and what we're worried about comes to pass and we have an enormous increase in the number of cases that potentially necessitates closing things down again, that's just going to be absolutely devastating for people.
It absolutely will. And do you in terms of where when you could see that happening, like could we potentially be seeing those cases rise towards the end of May, June?
Yeah, I mean, that's the tricky thing. So they've been rising in this past week. And, you know, we know now that the reopening of schools, you know, with very strong suspicions that that has been contributing to the increasing number of cases. But there's also been, you know, workplace outbreaks that have been contributing to it. Now, what I suppose the government have going for them is that the and they're probably, you know, betting on this in some ways, is that secondary schools are going to close in the next couple of weeks. Then we have primary schools just up through the end of June. It's possible that the closing, particularly closing secondary schools, even though they haven't been back very long, will help mitigate against this rise in cases that we're seeing. But, you know, I suppose we don't know, things aren't, that the first step happens on May 10th, so that's still about two weeks away. You know, we don't see the effect of that for two more weeks, right? Because it always takes about 2 weeks for the effect of those transmissions to really be seen in terms of case numbers. And if we were going to see anything in terms of, you know, for example, increased hospitalizations and ICU admissions, that won't happen for another couple of weeks, because there's always this really significant lag between, you know, when the cases start to rise and then when we start to see those more serious outcomes happen. So this is what, you know, what I was expressing at the very beginning. It's very troubling that the government have kind of backtracked on their, you know, promise to pay attention to data rather than dates, when this plan is completely based on dates. And if we are to see an effect in the data, it won't happen for quite a few weeks. And it's completely unclear what their response will be in that case, you know.
Yeah. No, I think you've set out a lot there, Claire, in terms of what we should be thinking about and what should have been considered and framed yesterday, and some really interesting ways of thinking about it as well. I think in terms of from a psychological perspective is really interesting. But I think the broader, in particular, I was struck by, you know, how you set out there the impacts of long COVID and across the population and how that needs to be considered. And the framing of it. So I really appreciate you coming on today to respond quite quickly to the relaxation of measures and what's going to happen. So hopefully I do, you know, think that this needs to be talked about more, and we need to bring this more into the conversation. And rather you being seen, I don't mean you personally, but ISAG and those who are, you know, being questioning the approach and still advocating, because I think, you know, there is still absolutely so much, as you've set out, that could be done that could keep us on a different path and aim for for suppression and elimination, that we really need to have this conversation rather than being seen as doom, you know, negative, you know, and party poopers, that actually this is serious. We need to listen to the signs.
Absolutely. And there was one thing that actually more that I wanted to say about that is, you know, often when psychologists and behavioral scientists talk about these, you know, shortcomings of human cognition and these heuristics and biases that people fall prey to, it's important to say that we, you know, those are things that happen generally when we're under time pressure or when we're in, you know, circumstances where I suppose, you know, partisan perspectives are emphasized and our social identities are brought to the fore or whatever. But, you know, humans are really capable of deliberative, rational decision making. All of us are, when given the space and given the support to do that. And I think citizens' assemblies, you know, are the greatest demonstration of that and the remarkable kinds of decisions that come out of the citizens' assemblies. And one of the things that I've seen recommended for the future, you know, when we start thinking about how are we going to handle the next pandemic? So, you know, hopefully this one is coming to an end and vaccines will spell the end of this this terrible time. But there will be another pandemic. And what we really need is to have a citizens' assembly where we can decide ahead of time what our response is going to be the next time. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, a citizens' assembly presented with the evidence on an elimination strategy would come down very firmly in favor of that approach next time round.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really interesting and good idea and something we should try and promote. And listen, if people want to find out more about the Independent Scientific Advocacy Group, you have websites.
Yeah, ISAGCOVID. To get it for you now.
Yeah, it's there anyway. They'll find it. Google it. They'll find it.
COVID-19.org. Yeah. So I mean, if they Google ISAG, you know, or the Independent Scientific Advocacy Group, they'll find us. And then we're on Twitter, of course. And we still have these weekly, you know, we're doing these weekly public meetings now. Usually on Wednesdays at 12, and it, you know, every week has a different topic. And they've been great because we, it provides a forum for people to ask questions and to have them answered by the panel. In addition to some, you know, there's usually a specific expert related to the topic of that week. So last week we had a fantastic session on long COVID, and that people can check that out on YouTube. And I think the links are provided on the ISAG website.
Yeah, no, it's great. It's a really, really, I think, important and useful resource in terms of, as you say, listening to the science and discussing this. So really appreciate and well done on that. Listen, Claire Kelly from Trinity College School of Psychology, thank you so much for joining me today on Reboot Republic.
Thank you, Rory. It was great.
Okay, and that's all for today. And I hope you found that engaging and interesting, as always. And a reminder, thank you very much to those who are patrons who are signed up. We really appreciate it, keeping the show on the road. And if you aren't, please consider signing up for $5 or $10 or €20, whatever you can. You can sign up each month, become a supporter, support the production of these podcasts, and sign up and guest the podcasts first from across the Tortoise Shack platform. And yep, we'll talk to you all soon. Thank you very much.